I belong to the Lansing Symphony, but I go around and substitute, or when they need additional players in other orchestras, including Grand Rapids, Kalamazoo, Toledo. I'm playing at the Opera in Detroit a fair amount this spring and off and on. So yeah, there's a lot of driving, but I like the variety. I like going to the different cities in Michigan and getting to know different people all over the place.
Cellist Stefan Koch, a symphony musician, a chamber musician. He has also performed with leading artists including Sarah Brightman, Anne Murray, Dionne Warwick, Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet, Dave Brubeck, Boys Choir of Harlem, Mannheim Steamroller, Doc Severinsen, and many others. For several years now, Stefan Koch has been helping to bring awareness to the music of Richard Stohr, a Jewish composer born Richard Stern, in 1874 in Vienna. Though he changed his name to Stohr while in medical school and converted to Christianity, the Nazis in the 1930s found out about Richard Stohr's Jewish roots and forced him to leave Austria. It was then, in 1938, that Stohr emigrated to the United States.
I came to know of Richard Stohr through a chance meeting with his grandson, Dan Stohr, who's an attorney in Chicago. And I was introduced to Dan through mutual friends in 2010. And at the time, he had just helped to release the first commercial CD of his grandfather's music, which is it's a CD on Austrian radio, ORF label. It has a string quartet, Stohr's first string quartet, and some piano music on it. And he was looking for other ways to reinvigorate his grandfather's legacy, because as we'll discuss, his grandfather is almost completely unknown as a composer in the world, really, but especially in the United States. And so I had never heard of his grandfather when Dan started telling me about him. And so I investigated and I found where the music is kept, the sheet music of Stohr's, which is in Vermont at the last college where he taught, St. Michael's College near Burlington. And Dan didn't even know if his grandfather had written any music for cello, but I was able to discover that there was a cello sonata and a group of short pieces, fantasy pieces. And I got that music from the college in Vermont, and I just started playing through the cello parts. And I was immediately struck with how good the music was. Without even having heard the piano parts yet, I could tell that the music was well-written and full of interesting ideas, beautiful melodies. And so then I found a pianist to play it with, and I just fell in love with the music right away. From that, I became very curious about the man and the composer and the artist and why we don't know anything about him, why he was completely unknown. There wasn't a Wikipedia article. There was nothing about him in 2010. So that's how I began the journey of getting to know as much as I could about Richard Stohr and performing his music as often as possible.
Richard Stohr's music is very much in the romantic style, though others of his generation, like Arnold Schoenberg, took off in other new directions.
That's true. Richard Stohr was actually born the same year as Arnold Schoenberg in Vienna. They were born in the same place, and their parents actually have similar backgrounds from the Hungarian part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So they were exact contemporaries, but they, as you noted, they went off in completely different musical directions. And Richard Stohr definitely stayed attached to his romantic roots. And all of his music, he wrote music up into the 1950s, and all of it has a romantic basis and a melodic, you know, a definite melodic basis and romantic forms. He, as a professor of music at the Vienna Academy, he was well acquainted with, he studied all the great composers and knew their music thoroughly, especially their chamber music, because he was a chamber music coach as well as professor of composition. And so he knew the chamber repertoire inside and out. And you can tell that he, when you get to know his works, you can tell that he knew the earlier composers very, very well. But his music always has his voice to it. His music is not sort of second or third rate Brahms or warmed over Schumann. It's really, he has his own voice, his distinctive compositional style, and his music does not sound like other composers' music, but you can still tell that he's steeped in the tradition.
Yeah. And that was a conscious decision on his part to hold true to those his style of composition.
That's true. I think he appreciated, he knew the music of the modern, you know, composers who were going in the modern direction, and he appreciated and respected it, but he felt he personally could not compose in that style. He actually composed about 70 works in the first 20 or so years of his compositional career, from about 1900 to 1920 or 21. He wrote 76, I believe is the correct number, of opus numbers in that time. And then he stopped composing for over 15 years. He didn't write anything from 1921 to 38. And then after he was exiled from Austria, Germany, by the Nazis, he took up composition again when he came to the United States, and he wrote about 65 or 70 more works in 10 or 15 years of productive life here. So, and those works are still romantic, as his earlier works were from Vienna. And so it's kind of interesting to think about why he stopped composing and then why he started again. We don't know exactly. I think he simply stopped because he felt he had said everything he had to say by 1920. At that point, he was 45 years old. And then I think he started composing again as a way to sort of cope with the disruption of his life, his family, his career, everything that happened to him in 1938. With the Nazis.
Yeah, we should say, we didn't say that before, that he's one of the Jewish composers whose music was banned, obviously, and one of the many composers whose lives were just torn apart because of it. He was one of the fortunate ones, in a sense, in that he got out before he ended up in one of the camps, like many of the other composers.
That's correct. He was born to a Jewish family, and in fact, the family name was Stern. His father was a professor of medicine at the University of Vienna, and his mother was a pianist who knew Franz Liszt. Her brother, this is Stor's mother's brother, was in the inner circle of Richard Wagner. They knew Nietzsche and Mahler and Freud and all these people in the central to the life of Vienna at the time. And most of those people were Jews, Richard Stohr saw the anti-Semitism that his father encountered as a professor in the university system, and so Richard converted to Christianity actually at the age of 24 in 1898 and changed his name to Stohr. We don't know why he chose the name Stohr. It is a name that other people have. It's a recognized name, and I guess I suspect he chose it just because it's a more sort of neutral German sounding name, not identifiably Jewish. And then he worked and lived as a non-Jew all that time. But when the Nazis took over Austria in 1938, they immediately found out through records or however that he had been born Jewish. And so he was declared a Jew and fired from his job immediately, as so many others were, as you pointed out. And so he immediately started looking for a job overseas in order to be able to emigrate. And he wrote letters to colleagues and former students all over the place. And he ended up actually at the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia. Mrs. Mary Bach Curtis herself hired him as a librarian at first, an assistant librarian. But once he got to Philadelphia, he then actually did teach courses at Curtis for a few years, and then ended up in Vermont by way of Curtis having to downsize during the war. Their enrollment declined, and they had to let go of some professors, not just the Jewish ones, but they downsized their faculty. And so he again went on the quest for employment and found a job at this small Catholic college near Burlington called St. Michael's. And that's where he ended his career. That's where he's buried. That's where his music, his sheet music, is preserved in the library there at St. Michael's.
Yeah. Did he? He didn't particularly. I take it that he didn't particularly feel that the college in Vermont was the most he could have wanted, but it was a place that he could concentrate on his composing more intensely.
That's correct. He had a difficult time finding a position in 41, 42 when he had to leave Curtis. He wrote letters to every music school in the United States, I think. We know this because he kept a log of his correspondence. We don't have the actual letters, but he was one of these people that when he wrote a letter, he made a note of it in a log. And in that time period of 41, 42, he wrote letters to dozens and dozens of music schools, including the University of Michigan. But no one had a position open at the time, and so he ended up in Vermont. And again, he was, yes, as you note, he was underutilized there. He taught German language courses. He taught some music courses. And they didn't even really have a full-time position for him. His salary was supplemented by funds from organizations that were helping immigrants. He taught at two other small schools in Vermont, one in Montpelier and another one in Burlington, just giving lessons or doing anything he could to make a little bit, just to make enough money to live.
This was part one of my conversation with cellist Stefan Koch. I met up with him at Guarneri House in Hudsonville, where he was having some work done on one of his instruments. Guarneri House was very gracious in allowing us to invade their instruments display room to record. Segments of our interview will be heard on future dates. Stefan Koch has recorded Richard Storr's cello pieces on two Toccata Classics CDs, the first released in 2014 and the second just released a few months ago. The remaining segments of our conversation will be broadcast in the near future. You can listen to this segment online at our website, wmuk.org. Thank you.